Hello, this is Shireen Gourbani, and you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm a former Salt Lake County Council member. I was a Democrat. I represent the left, and I have with me
John Dougal, and we're unsupervised. I'm your state auditor, and it's just the two of us today, this is so fun.
Normally, we have Natalie Gochner, who represents the political center.
Keeps us on task.
And John, where do you fall on the political spectrum?
I fall very far to the right, shades of libertarian, small L libertarian, so yeah. Very limited government.
Yeah, that's right. So we're jumping in here on our radio show, and it comes out as a podcast, to talk a little bit about what some are calling the podcast election. I'm wondering if you can talk about any interesting interviews that you've heard with either, you know, Trump or Harris, or I actually know that we happen to both listen to one with J.D. Vance this weekend.
Are you telling me that you don't watch Fox News?
I don't.
Don't worry, I don't watch cable news either. So, I heard the J.D. Vance New York Times, The Daily, did an interview with him that I heard this morning. So that was kind of interesting. And you saw kind of the two shades of J.D. Vance. You saw the kindler, thoughtful J.D. Vance that you saw during the debate with Tim Walz.
Yeah.
And then you had him trying to defend Donald Trump and trying to toe the line there, where you could see, you know, he was really doing his best to toe the line, but maybe he wasn't fully bought into some of what he was saying.
Yeah. So there were many interesting twists and turns in this interview. A couple that really stood out to me were the fact that J.D. Vance simply would not say that he would certify this election. He kind of continued, I would say, Trump's lies about the election in the last election. And really, I agree with you. I think kind of towing the Trump line or carrying water for Trump, it feels like he's been directed to do that. I would say it's a bit out of character for some of the other places where he seems more principled. But
he did also try and back up and apologize for his inarticulate cat lady comments.
He did.
But he tried to explain why he feels like America has become more anti-family.
Yeah.
And there's a part of me that thinks America has become more pro-family, but at the same time, there's a part that also makes it feel like it's become less pro-family, or even to a certain extent anti-family in some areas.
Give me an example of how you think this country has become more pro-family.
Well, when I grew up, and you saw it even, you know, decades before, it was basically kids are to be seen but not heard. Mm. And now you're seeing much more, you know, whether it was COVID with Zoom calls and, you know, your kids there in the call and stuff like that, you see kids much more prevalent. I think part of the other dynamic is I grew up, I'm the oldest of 11 kids.
Yeah.
And so I was very unsupervised a lot of my life.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, my mom and dad were spread so thin. Now you've got, you know, lots of helicopter parents, and we're hearing about some of the concerns with helicopter parents, but they're so overscheduling their kids and they're there for every moment and making sure they've got this great quote unquote childhood. And they can do that when there's only one or two kids in the family.
Yeah. Now, before we get back to the Vance interview, I want to dip into another interview that I heard on, exactly as you're suggesting, on The Daily this last week about parents not being all right in this country. And a big part of it, helicopter, I think, is one way to put it. There's also just sort of this like high intensity or high contact parenting. The stat that stood out in that absolutely shook me was that a stay-at-home mom in the 70s was actually spending like hours per week less time with their child or children than working parents are today. And when you think about that kind of interplay, the amount of time that parents feel that they're expected to be putting in with their kids, there have been a lot of shifts. I think there are shifts in the way that homework is treated. I think there are shifts in the way that social activities are organized. Many, many reasons for that. But I do think it's a disturbing trend and explains why I think many, I hope other mothers listening can relate to that sense of just feeling like we can never keep up with the expectations. But on that, I'll say one of the things that stood out for me in the J.D. Vance interview that I just found actually really troubling in terms of a worldview was his commentary on basically people choosing not to have children because of climate change being a hysterical or radical position, right? I thought that this was really strange, in large part because the data shows that a lot of the reasons that people choose, for example, to terminate pregnancies is economic, right? It's not people who are choosing not to have children because of climate change is such a small sliver of the population that I thought that seemed like a little bit of a convenient choice for a group to subset out that probably would never vote for him anyway. Do you know what I'm saying? Like to sort of soften the edges of that commentary.
And I guess I heard it a little bit different.
Okay.
I heard it more, if you're using politics to decide whether or not you have a family, you're doing it wrong.
Okay.
There's lots of factors that go into it, choosing to have a family or not. Don't let politics drive it.
Okay.
And you may have economic issues or other experiences, but don't let the politics drive that choice.
I would also just add that the economics of raising a family are political. They are political. Who you vote for matters in terms of that. So let's shift over and talk a little bit about...
Can I ask you a question, though?
Yeah.
You talked about the podcast election.
Yeah.
Okay, so why the podcast? And you've run for federal office before.
Yeah.
How do you reach the voters? And why are they going down this path to reach voters versus the traditional TV news channels, whatever it might be?
Well, you also ran for federal office.
I did.
A quick insight on this from you would also be interesting. But I'll tell you, one of the things that was most stunning to me is I did kind of local conservative media when I was driving out to knock on doors in Delta. I remember having to pull over on like a certain stretch of road so that I had good reception so I could call into a radio show. I showed up on people's blocks like shortly thereafter, and somebody actually said to me, "I heard you on the radio when I was driving to work this morning," right? And I think that there is, there is always the effort. I think when you are running, it is incumbent upon you to try to reach people where they are. So conservative talk radio is where people were, out in that side of the state. We invested really heavily in social media ads because we knew more eyes would see that than would see it on, especially a demographic I'm trying to pull in usually, right? As opposed to watching evening news. But yeah, I'm wondering if you have thoughts on this changing environment.
I mean, if you go back, when I was a kid, in the 70s, you had basically three major channels, and all your news came through those three major channels. And we fractured so much that when I ran, just a few months ago, it was really hard to figure out how do you reach the audience and where are they at? Because there's not really, it's not like everybody's listening to one radio station or everybody's, watching a certain set of TV shows. It is so ultra fractured.
Yeah.
How do you reach them? And so, clearly folks are going after podcasts, but even then, you're only reaching a certain set of folks.
Yeah, that's right. Well, so in other kind of presidential news, I guess, there's an article out about how Harris has vowed to create a bipartisan advisory council. So not only has she said that she'll have a Republican in her cabinet, but that she's...
One of those weird Republicans?
Yeah. Well, but that she's also going to create some sort of structure that would allow for a bipartisan council of advisors who can give feedback on policy as she goes forward. What do you think of that? What's your take?
For certain folks, I think that can be good. It shows that you're reaching across the aisle. In others, it depends on the nature of who's involved.
Yeah.
And how much participation you really get. I'm a little cynical because I've seen that, I've got the token Republican or I've got the token Democrat.
Yeah.
So you can claim that it's bipartisan, but they never have a seat at the table. You never listen to any of their input. They're never really engaged in the discussion. They're just kind of this token figurehead. And so at the end of the day, it really depends how are they engaged in the administration. To what extent are they really representing that? And to what extent is it just to make a claim that I did something?
Yeah. So I would say it's raising something else for me. I've heard that also, progressives are a little troubled by sort of her what feels like move to the right. I guess I would say this. I think it's important to have differing perspectives, especially when it actually comes down to, leading and lawmaking. I do think that it can be a sign of a good leader, a strong leader, to bring in differing opinions. I'll also add that as a person...
Well, you look at Abraham Lincoln, his team of rivals.
Classic example.
Man, he brought in... He was such a comfortable leader. He was willing to bring his rivals to the table and get their input.
Yeah, and I think that we actually do... I would say even just the small conversations that we have here every week shape how I think about and how I perceive folks on the other side of the aisle or Republicans generally. Not certainly like deeply Trump... MAGA Republicans, that's harder. It's a harder space for me. But I think principled Republicans, I can understand, I can extend my thinking, open my aperture to understand perspectives coming in from that side because we have these conversations. So I do think that that is important. But I guess what I would say is a person who is anti-war and deeply anti-poverty, I'm feeling a little left out of all this. I think I certainly am excited about, the Harris campaign. I'm excited about especially some of the, I think, incredibly family forward policies that have come out of Minnesota that I would love to see replicated on the national scale. But as a person who really holds tight, I would say, to a desire to see a deeply exciting and energizing, climate policy or, like I said, anti-poverty policy, thinking about the way that we invest in like our highly militarized country, I can see the criticism and I sometimes wonder, luckily Democrats still let me call myself that.
So why is she doing this?
I think because there are probably more voters who absolutely understand that a Donald Trump second term would be a true risk to our democracy. And saying, you know, I can pull you in, we can work together, is Kamala Harris really does care about this country and about this democracy. I fundamentally don't believe that Donald Trump does. And I think there are more voters probably in that pocket than there are in mine.
So why is she reaching out, though, to put Republicans on the cabinet, though?
Yeah, like I said, I
think it comes down, partly from my perspective, it comes down to voters. And in the swing voters, she's trying to say, I'm trying to do something to pick up some of those folks.
Yeah.
I'm willing to throw a few policies out there. I'm willing to do this type of thing.
Yeah.
Whether it's a stunt or really meaningful, sincere, she's trying to do that to pick up, which says to me, this election is really too close to call,
yeah.
And she can see that it's too close to call. And that's where we're at.
Yeah, yeah, that's where we're at. But I also think it can be a genuine way that she is. And my guess is being in the Senate, which has long been noted for the need for folks to work together, had an impact on her politics, on her policies. So I do think it's likely genuine. It makes me feel a little left out.
No, I totally understand. And it doesn't cause somebody like me to say, oh, I want to jump on and support her.
Yeah.
And I look and I'm concerned with a Harris administration, a Biden administration to me, as you know, I believe has been a disaster.
Yeah. But you also have real concerns about a Trump administration.
I have concerns with the Trump administration as well. So yeah. I have concerns. It doesn't matter. And Congress, from my perspective, is utterly dysfunctional.
Yeah.
On both sides. They are. They're fiscally irresponsible and not in no... No notion is there of any kind of limited government perspective. So.
Yeah. Well, while Harris is creating these kinds of proposals around bipartisanship, Trump is proposing retribution and calling out the military on the radical left. So these really are different people with very different visions about what's happening in our country. But we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll be talking about local news. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right. And you're listening Both Sides of the Aisle.
Unsupervised.
Unsupervised. There you go. Natalie's not here. Shh, don't say. Hey, but speaking of Natalie, last week she had a question. She was complaining about the power lines that were in the air and saying, hey, in my community, they're buried underground. And why don't they do this in Florida and places down where they have hurricanes?
I love how you said complaining. I think she was wondering.
Well, she was wondering. it's
opining.
Opining on what it could be given what we do here in Utah. There you go. And Anna, one of our listeners, thank you so much, because we put it out there to say, hey, if somebody has more information, please share it. I had mentioned possibly cost as one factor. I wondered about this, but Anna confirmed. She says that also the water tables are too high for the underground utilities. And yeah. That's one of the other reasons that they're above ground down there in the South.
Yeah. A Utahan, former New Orleanian, wrote in to let us know, and we appreciate the commentary.
So, thank you so much. Thanks for listening. And Anna, thank you for the insights.
Yes. And we love it when listeners reach out to us. But one thing that's happening to you all listeners as registered voters, which I'm sure you are, is by the time you're hearing this, ballots should be arriving.
And if, yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
You got them. We're mailing them to you, whether you like it or not. It's
okay.
Supposedly so you can do the research. So please go do the research, study the candidates, study the issues.
Yeah. So what happens if your ballot didn't arrive? What should people do?
Well, first you can go to vote.utah.gov. Mm-hmm. You can type in there and track your ballot.
Yeah.
So you can look and see whether the county thinks they've mailed it to you or not.
That's right.
And if they've mailed it to you and you wait a few days and it hasn't arrived, go ahead and reach out to the county. They can send you a new ballot.
That's right. So there's a deadline. You want to check that on vote.utah.gov to make sure that you are ahead of the deadline to request the ballot if you did not receive one. But you are also able to continue to, you can vote in person. Early voting will start shortly after this. And then you can certainly vote in person on election day. We also have the opportunity for you folks who, if you find out that for some reason you aren't registered, please go check now. It's much easier to do in advance, but you can also vote provisionally in the state. So you would still be able to vote on election day. with the right documentation.
And if you mail in your ballot, you can track whether they've received it and whether they've counted it.
Yeah, that's right. So I love our tracking system. Yeah, I love our tracking system. And I always encourage people to do it early, but really going in and having the time to think about what's on your ballot, do research on the candidates. Sometimes you can even, especially across our counties that are a little less populated, you can often get them on the phone at this point. So I recommend doing your research and reaching out to candidates.
Don't bother studying Amendment D. And don't bother studying Amendment A.
That's right. So Amendment A, which was a change in the income tax earmark for education, and Amendment D, which I would describe as a deceitful power grab from the legislature to take away
but
your ability,
you really feel?
ability to put ballot initiatives forward in this state. Both have been voided by the Utah Supreme Court. Ultimately, the decisions went up to the Utah Supreme Court. And in part, it was language that was misleading, but both failed to meet the requirement to be printed in media. So when we talk about this being a podcast election, think about a changing media environment, but they weren't in print.
This is one of the things. The legislature is to cause these amendments to be published in a newspaper of general circulation in each of these counties.
Yeah.
Ask yourself, what does a newspaper mean today?
Yeah.
And that's a constitutional requirement of a newspaper. And so I think the legislature needs to come back, run a constitutional amendment to clarify what a newspaper means in the 21st century.
Yeah, or what constitutes notification, right, yep. When you want to see that constitution change. So watch for that, because I'm sure it's coming. So we do have some other political news on the local.
And you might ask, why is BNC still on the ballot?
No one challenged them in court.
They have not yet been challenged. So therefore, lacking the challenge, they're still on the ballot.
That's right. So do your research on BNC. Please vote on those. But Amendment A and D, you can skip. They will not be counted. So we've got news of our gubernatorial race. So the King
campaign. Is that on the ballot?
Brian King, a former representative, really wonderful, I would say, leader of Democrats in our state, has taken on the always challenging position of running for governor. It's great. We're grateful to have
someone.
Are
you saying it's like tilting a windmills?
Well, except for this poll.
The great underdog.
That was conducted September 27th and 28th by public policy polling shows Cox in the lead with 35%, followed by King at 24%, Republican write-in candidate Phil Lyman at 19%, the Libertarian Latham is coming in at 3%, and a sizable portion of voters, 18%, aren't sure. So this really, I think, is asking the question, if enough people decide to go and write in Phil Lyman, what do you think the outcome could be?
Well, clearly what Brian's hoping is it steers it to him. And I know there's various Republicans that have expressed displeasure with Phil Lyman, not the other Lymans, but Phil Lyman particularly, over his writing campaign that, you know, he's basically trying to throw the election to Brian King. Now, he'll quickly say, no, I'm not. But for a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill, that's what they think he's trying to do.
I can understand the frustration there.
And clearly, Brian's probably getting hopeful. Oh, you're telling me there's a chance.
Yeah. Well,
that 18%, I think, is going to split, you know, two-third Republican, one-third Democrat.
But, typically does. Yeah. I guess I would also just add that if you're tired of, largely a government that you feel may not be listening to you, having some checks of power may be a good idea. You could put a Democrat in that seat. While we know the state legislature has taken quite a bit of power away from the governor, there are still things that a governor can do. And I do think it would be good for us to have more balance in our state government. So just a thought for folks, if you're tired of one party control, if you are frustrated with how things are in Utah, shake it up.
Man, you didn't sell me on that one. Did not sell me there at all.
Well, let me see.
What's
I
one
can
of the things I would love is for them to limit the size of government and limit the amount of spending, because spending has grown significantly.
As a person who keeps running for office, I find this such a surprising commentary from you. So let me see if I can sell you on this. So Utah has a homelessness problem that is not actually dissimilar from other states of our size. In fact, when we look at the
rates, as we've joked, it has unfortunately not been solved.
It has not been solved, and
in the past,
it is also increasing, not at the rate that we're seeing in, I would say, more urbanized states. Though we are a very urbanized state, but the rate at which our population of unhoused individuals is growing is not as rapid as we're seeing in some of our bigger cities, but it certainly is growing. And for me, I would say this was a pretty frustrating news item that I saw come out, which is that the Utah's Homeless Policy Board, under the direction of appointed leaders from the state government, is now proposing that we go back to a 1,200-bed shelter with resources, so job assistance, healthcare, and food on site, in a yet-to-be-determined 30-acre site along the Wasatch Front. Now,
so
when I say go back,
says somebody's picked out something they just haven't told us
haven't
yet.
Told
is what
us
that
yet.
Sounds like.
But tell me why I had to say go back. Do you remember the? I'm sure you do. The twists
well,
and turns.
Well, we used to talk about a centralized road home type yep. of site, and then we were going to spread it around the Wasatch Front, especially around Salt Lake County. There's some blowback in places like Draper,
yeah.
not in my backyard.
And Sugar House, honestly.
And Sugar House, you know,
yeah.
not in my backyard. It was both from Republican and Democrat folks. It was not like one party or the other. And this is one of the things I see too often in government. We can't solve problems, so we kind of whipsaw back and forth. Centralized, decentralized.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it too often doesn't actually address the issue. And I think what a lot of folks are going to be concerned with is we're going to go to a centralized site. It's going to be a big site. You're going to have problems in the close proximity, and we're still going to have homeless scattered around. And are we going to push them out of sight, out of mind, and not address the issues? And it's a very challenging population
yeah.
to address, whether it's mental illness or other lack of skills
trauma.
And so forth, trauma,
yeah.
that makes it very
addiction.
Difficult to help them get housed and overcome some of these other challenges in their life.
Yeah, so I have to. There are a couple things that stand out to me in this. One is the amount of dollars that are spent on transportation. So this dispersed model that we have that involves, there are a couple of resource centers in Salt Lake City. We've got South Salt Lake has also stepped forward in a big way to house a large resource center. The amount of transportation that goes back and forth between these is a cost. It's difficult. There are also not food services or healthcare services co-located. One of the things that the Road Home site that used to be downtown offered is that the 4th Street Clinic was around the corner. St. Vincent's was around the corner. So there was a sense of a centralization of a campus to provide support. It also happened to be interspersed with Pioneer Park, with businesses. And I understand the challenges.
And businesses were complaining about the mayhem that was happening on the streets
sure.
and impairing their businesses.
Sure. And folks who couldn't find beds were also, you know, complaining about the experience, the mayhem that they were experiencing trying to find shelter. So I think we know that we're short. We know that there are not enough beds for folks who are experiencing homelessness in our state. One of the things that's so frustrating to me is I do continue to believe that Utah is still at this sort of sweet spot where if we wanted to actually solve this problem, to really invest in the kind of infrastructure that's needed to help stabilize people, move them into a longer term, you know, supportive housing, move them into employment, move folks into or onto disability, into healthcare that they may need. Certainly addiction treatment services is part of that. This is a small enough problem that if we had the political will, we could do this. It is still within our reach to do this. So I hope whatever happens here, that we are not shortchanging the actual cost that it is to move people into stabilization.
And I'm going to say this isn't a question of political will. I mean, in the past, you've seen Greg Hughes, Speaker of the House, really focus on this, trying to solve this issue. You've seen Wayne Niederhauser, who's currently there, the director of these efforts, former Senate president. So there's been a lot of political will. There's been a lot of money that the legislature has appropriated to this. It is just a very challenging, difficult problem.
It is. And it's one that I actually believe that we could solve. We could get a lot closer to solving than we are. I'll say with a few of those folks, when we see kind of the cycling through of people because of political wins or change or they leave office or whatever, sometimes they come back into it. We gave an example of that. But often these are fundamentally underfunded. The request that comes in is often shortchanged. And I think that there is this kind of sense that, I hear from politicians, usually Republicans, saying that this is a system that's not working. It's not working. And they continue to be skeptical about the requests, the financial requests that come in to support this work. There has to be some meeting in the middle there to understand that if you underfund a program, if you underfund a facility, if you underfund this effort, it is never going to get the work done.
Yeah. And I'm going to say oftentimes government is more able to deal with acute issues than chronic issues. And this is one of those chronic issues.
Sure. So we're getting close on time, but I want to add an interesting bit of news that came from the Salt Lake Tribune, looking at the 13 books that were banned across Utah schools. And the question was, how often did they actually get checked out?
Like never.
Like almost never. So a number of the books were checked out, not at all. There was one in particular that was checked out, I believe, 66 times. That's one that is a pretty popular, I would say, sort of like science It's a fantasy. It's like a fantasy novel kind of series.
Right up my genre.
You're
right?
Not a fantasy reader? I'm actually not a fantasy reader either. But the thing that's, I think, quite startling about this is, you know, you think about the hysteria around, at least how I experienced it, around these books that simply had to be pulled out of our schools. I think about, you know, Representative Ivory repeatedly bringing these and reading them at the legislature. I wonder if he checked them out, because these books were not checked out at all.
I look and go, it's not really a ban if nobody's looking at them. So, you know, what's the big to-do on the opposition of trying to get these out of the libraries?
So I would say the bigger question is, why are we so afraid of ideas? But on top of that, I'll just add that we had two school districts report that over $29,000 of taxpayer money went to reviewing the banned books and then pulling them out of school. So these were just administrative costs. Your tax dollars, as far as I'm concerned, completely flushed down the toilet.
And how much was spent on reviewing books or not reviewing books to put them in the libraries in the first place?
So typically that is a person's job that's already part of, you know, creating a vigorous learning environment where people get exposed to ideas that may challenge them. Anything else?
Clearly we're unsupervised today.
I know. So
we're going to go off to the library.
Yeah, we hope you vote. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Shereen Gorbani.
John Dougal. Listen to those podcasts about the upcoming election.
You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. Our producer is Anthony Scumma, and hopefully Natalie Gochner will be with us next week.